Hi, my name is Dick G, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
It is not with great concern over my anonymity that I use my last initial. Actually, my last name is Grant, and I understand that is not met with great favor down here. That's not what you call a grabber in show business, I understand. One of my misguided relatives. I have been accused from time to time of being close to him, that people understand his first name was useless. And I used to have a lot of discussions with authority figures about that. We, first of all, both Jay and I would very much like to thank you all for asking us down here. It's a long way from Parker, Colorado to Atlanta, Georgia, in a lot of ways. And it sure is a long way from a Sunday night meeting in Santa Barbara, California on February 16th, 1969 until tonight. And we have had a new life since that time, and to have it enriched by an experience like this is something that's hard to describe. I don't know about you, but I didn't get asked a lot of places there toward the end. More than once. But Jay and I are really most appreciative. This is really the first chance we've had to come down in this country and get to see an event, an anonymous member of your fellowship named Bill R. was kind enough to give us his tour of Atlanta yesterday, and we saw the downtown and some of the gracious homes and this beautiful way of life that you have here. And so we would like to thank you very much, because you've given us an opportunity to share an experience as husband and wife. And it's nice now that we are sharing those experiences as husband and wife. I don't know about you, but we used to be able to live further apart in one small apartment than any two human beings on earth. And we thank you for having us very much, and thanks to the committee for asking us and bringing us down here. I don't know, despite the many efforts that I made in my early years in AA to try to improve on the format, thinking that perhaps now maybe you had been blessed with that opportunity to upgrade yourselves that I was here. I've still been unsuccessful at doing that, so I will attempt to stick to the directions. I have been blessed with those kind of sponsors that say things like, "Dick, when you've tried everything else, try doing it the right way." And that is to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I don't plan on sharing a lot with you about how to get sick. I think you probably know about as much about that as you need. I don't know that there's a group of individuals on earth who know more about how to get sick than we do, whether or not we are the ones that were drinking the alcohol. And I do believe this is a family disease, and that's why it's really an opportunity to come here and share this with my wife. I was born into a family of two alcoholic parents. That does not make you alcoholic, in my opinion. In fact, if anything, as a young man, I probably made more pledges than the normal 10-year-old that I would never be like them. And I swore many, many times that I would never become anything like what they were like. I was born into a home that had a lot of material affluence. My father was a very successful, well-intentioned, and very hard-working and dedicated man. He raised himself up out from a little farm boy in northern Utah to being a vice president of one of the biggest corporations in the United States. The only thing that he had to share with me later was that was one of the biggest mistakes that he ever made in his life. So I am grateful for that lesson that he gave me. Both of my parents were alcoholic. That made for a somewhat exciting and unique childhood. But I want you to know that it wasn't all bad. The first thing I did when the old man got drunk was to roll him. And I was one of the best-heeled kids in fourth grade. I used to also do the same to my mother. And so, fortunately, they rarely got drunk at the same time, so I had a pretty steady source of income there. all the while feeling terribly superior to my own parents. I believe that I was the type of alcoholic, and I don't want to get into a controversy over how you get to be alcoholic. Whether you're one of the ones that was like I was just an alcoholic waiting for his first drink by the time I was probably 6, 7, 8, or 9. Or you may be the type that was sitting on a bar stool one day and suddenly came down alcoholic. I don't... I don't know which kind you are, but I was the former. By the time I was very young, by the time I was 8 or 9, I'm sure that I had the set of emotions and mentalities and attitudes toward life that would make me natural prey for something or someone who could take me out of reality and try to make me feel differently about myself and differently about the world than the way I felt. Because I was completely uncomfortable, I was completely out of step, and I was completely dedicated to proving that you would never find that out. They used to have toys, and I don't know if they still make them, and it's hard to describe alcoholism, I think, to people. And one of the ones that occurred to me not long ago is, do you remember the kinds of toys where they had made out of pieces of wood, and string from the various other parts ran through a centerpiece of wood? And if you pulled all those pieces of string, the toy would snug up against itself and be tight. Have you ever seen them? That's my first drink. That's exactly what I felt like the first time I ever took a drink of alcohol. It was as though somebody had taken those strings and pulled all the pieces up tight together. And I thought, yeah, that's how I thought it was supposed to feel like when you were alive. I never will forget that feeling, and I never had it again. I was either one hamburger short or two drinks long on that feeling for the rest of my life. I used to think maybe if I drank olive oil and milk before I went out, I'd get it back. Or if I had a drink before going drinking, then it would be all right. And there was always one of the strings that I forgot to pull, and there was some piece flapping out there all the time in my life. And that was alcoholism for me. My first drink of alcohol was another fellow and I stole some booze from his father. We went out and sat in a park in a bunch of trees. It was something stupid like peppermint schnapps or something like that. We didn't know what we were into. But I remember the feeling when I took that first couple of drinks. That felt mighty fine. And, of course, I drank enough that I got sick, threw up, passed out, woke up a few hours later feeling terrible, thinking, I got to do that again just about as fast as I can. I hopped on my bicycle, went weaving down the road, smashed into the side of the house, and began that series of conversations with authority figures that I referred to earlier. They were always very one-sided conversations. I felt totally intimidated and thought how unfair it was I have to keep going through all these conversations that I've been having all my drinking life. By the time I was 20, I was suicidal. I wished that I'd had the courage to commit suicide. I was trying to think of all the options, of all the ways you could do it without people knowing about it, because it would be a blur on the escutcheon of the family. Now, this is that same family, remember, that's got two alcoholic parents. I remember as a young man often driving along the highway, sober as I could be in those days, thinking about, I wish I had the nerve to pull the wheel and drive into the embankment or the cement post along the side. I'm led to understand that's not normal for young teenagers to feel that way, unless you're alcoholic. And then it's just par for the course. And that's the way I felt about living. I, from time to time, was cursed with rare moments of self-honesty and would actually talk to somebody about the fact that I had a problem and I didn't know what to do about it. I didn't let that happen very often because I was taught, and in my social world, it wasn't important how sick or how miserable you were inside as long as you kept up the front. I had that drummed into me, that they, whoever they were watching, taking score, and discussing it behind your back. I think it's a tribute to the insanity of our disease that we will almost kill ourselves trying to please them whom, if we knew, we would feel superior to. But I tried to pull off that act for a long time, and it got worse and worse. I graduated from college. I went to college because I didn't know what else to do. My life was not one of a programmed, orderly process marching smartly along to some predetermined goal. Mine was, I'm just going to kill tomorrow and see what happens. And I got out of high school, and they said, well, what are you going to do now? And I said, I suppose I'm going to college. And then it occurred to me that I was living in a state where you could drink beer at 18, whatever it was. And so my friend said, well, I'm going back east to college. Where are you going? And I said, well, why would I want to leave here? You got to be 21 to drink back there. And that's how I picked my college. As Napoleon said after Waterloo, it seemed like a good idea at the time. So that's where I went to school. And I mostly drank beer, was able to go to as few classes as possible and maintain what F. Scott Fitzgerald referred to as the gentlemanly C grade average. I tried like crazy to sell that to my father, that whole concept, and it was met with total disdain. I told him that I couldn't waste all my time on studies. I was out acquiring social graces. And he said, you mean like the time you came home from college for Christmas and we found you passed out on the front steps? And we went on vacation and you stayed home and you were in alcoholic tremors for 2 weeks by yourself? He said, is that the social graces that you're acquiring? And I said, yeah, I just had a run of bad luck that day. But that's what my life was like. After getting out of college, I was being pursued by the local draft board, and I felt it was beneath my dignity to march and dig. So I joined the Navy. And I found out that that was a good deal. The only reason I was not court-martialed out of the United States Navy was that I was an officer. In those days, they seemed to have a strong drive not to have their officers get court-martialed for the kind of behavior that I was exhibiting, because I wasn't any big, bad alcoholic. My drunkalog is possibly one of the dullest I've ever heard. Some of the old boys out there in Southern California used to tell me, Sonny, I've spilled more on my tie than you got down. And I used to think to myself, damn, I wish that weren't true. I had an absolute lack of tolerance for the chemical ethanol. I could only drink a little bit and then suffer with hangovers for about 3 days. I can only characterize my hangovers as having the sensation that you were standing with your hands over your ears, your mouth tightly closed, and that the noise of the thing must have been leaking out so everybody could hear it. My hangovers were like a symphony out of sync going on inside of my head. United States Navy and I failed to agree on my curriculum and my time schedule. They didn't understand how they had to call me in and ask why I was standing in the middle of a runway waving in a flight of bombers. Why I had been arrested for organizing and participating in the first annual naked hedge hopping contest in Coronado, California. And why I was unable to go flying because I'd gone out of the back end of a sports car at 40 miles an hour with nothing but a pair of swim trunks on. So being persecuted and hounded relentlessly, I decided that I should do something about the quality of my life. Now, I searched around, and I came up with what I thought was a very unique and very intelligent, because now, of course, remember, by this point, I have firmly convinced that I am truly the turning point in human intellectual development. Don't know why no one else has acknowledged this yet, but have found that beautiful Hemingway suffering syndrome of when you are as special and different as I am, and you are cast loose in this unthinking, unfeeling world, the only way you can get along is to sedate yourself like a gentleman. I see we could start a club here tonight. So I came up with what I thought was a particularly unique idea was I was going to straighten myself out, right? You know how you do that? You get married. I believe that much of that clear thinking was the foundation of Al-Anon. You know, and frankly, I don't think they've ever acknowledged what we've done for them. Somehow I was protected, though, because I can honestly say that 14 years later, that in spite of my sickness and my stupidity and my arrogance, that for some reason a power greater than myself got me married to exactly the right woman. I don't often remember that as well and as frequently as I should. It is by being sick, and it is by having done things for the wrong reasons, and being able, through the process of the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I am able to realize now that in spite of me, there has been something working in my life consistently, unerringly, at all times, which was always giving me the option to become better, weller, or whatever you want to call it. And the times that I have claimed and called upon those promises and that power, that my life has been dramatically changed. And there's no more clear place than my marriage. I was the kind of alcoholic whose denial system consisted partly of course, the biggest part of the denial system was the intellectual syndrome. I used the intellectual approach to excuse away all my actions. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 30 years old and a mass of unrealized potential. One of these days, I was going to get around to using that potential on a regular and consistent basis and watch out whenever I did. But in the meantime, things were going along pretty much as they'd gone along since the time I had that first drink. I would like to share with you the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as it has come to me, to this alcoholic who walked into his first AA meeting on February 16, 1969 in Santa Barbara, California, with about as much humility as a Prussian general. Sick at heart and sick at mind, and one of those tributes to the fact that we come here with a fatal disease. Most of us, as we were talking about at dinner tonight, have tried absolutely everything else we could before we came here. And in my case, that was every intellectual trick and device that has ever been known to man. Every lie and every deceitful thing that I could possibly do to avoid facing the simple fact that I was an alcoholic, that my life had become unmanageable, that no human power was going to relieve it. I think it's a tribute that we can come here in that kind of condition, and in my case, and in my kind of alcoholism, the first thing I did when I walked through the doors of that meeting was to try to impress upon you that I didn't need it. I spent the next year of my life, and I can truthfully and honestly share with you that that was the worst year of my life. The year that I spent after drinking and doing nothing else was the worst year I've ever spent in my life. Because I took away the single part of my life that was key to my very existence, to my justification, to my mental ease, whatever I had, to my personality, to my social consciousness of myself and every other part. It was the one key integral part that touched every single part of my life. And I removed that and I didn't replace it with anything else. And for those of you who may be new, I would like to share with you that it is not necessary when somebody walks up to you and you're a newcomer and you're dying inside and you're frightened and you're wondering if you're in the right place and you're looking for answers that you finally know that you don't have. You don't have to, when they walk up and say, "How are you?" you don't have to smile and say, "Fine." Because you know something? We will allow you to do that unto death. You have that right to smile and to lie to us and to yourself and die doing it. Because that is your right. What we have to offer, in my opinion, is that the first time you will let down and say, "Well, to tell you the truth, I really need some help." However you need to say that. If you will just do that, we can promise you that that same trickle of honesty will turn into a waterfall of recovery and health. I was reading the 12 by 12 today, and it talked about that trickle. It was in step 11. It talked about that first little trickle of self-honesty. And for some reason, the image came in my mind of one time being out west where we have those big roaring rivers that come down through canyons. I remember standing in one of those canyons next to one of those huge rivers right under a waterfall. The noise is enormous. You can hardly hear your own thoughts. And I compared my life today with that sensation compared to the trickle of honesty when the first time I did, which happened to be 1 year after I was sober, when I got up in front of a bunch of people in Beverly Hills, California, in front of a bunch of flaky guys at a stag meeting that was in a park in Beverly Hills. And I had left that meeting because I was so full of fear and anxiety and so full of self that I had walked in the meeting, sat down, and couldn't understand why nobody came up and talked to me and why they didn't share and hug and with me in the way they did each other. The only reason they didn't was I was sitting in the back all by myself with my head down, and if anybody came near to me, I got up and went to the men's room. And I walked out of that meeting that night, and I started to walk across that park. And I got partway across, and I was cutting through, and it was dark, and it was completely black that night. And I was swept over with fear that I have never felt before in my life, and I realized that this place, this AA thing that I didn't understand, was not participating in, and frankly had great contempt and hate for at that time, out of my sickness. But this was the last stopping place that I could visualize a bar on La Cienega that I was going to be in that night before I got home. And I turned around and walked back inside that meeting, sat down in the back of the thing, and started praying to something I'd made fun of all my life. To please help me once. So that honesty came, first of all, between my own 2 years. And isn't it funny that out of the 50 people in that meeting, that 15 up, that I was one of the ones called on? I got up in front of the thing, and I didn't know what to say. And all I could do was start crying and saying, I think I'm flunking AA. Still putting it in the terms of winning and losing, the whole success syndrome, the whole thing. And from that moment on, I can promise you that I have been standing by a river ever since, and that river keeps getting bigger. Keep using that analogy. I came into the program. I criticized. I immediately sized you up by the way you dressed, how you drank your coffee, spoke. And you know the funny thing about comparing yourself with other people is you never tie. I always pretended to come out better, but deep down felt lower. But I never tied with anybody. That night, after I had blubbered up in front of the meeting for a few moments, I went over and sat down in the back, and of course my first sensation was one of embarrassment, right? Whoops, let the front down a little bit there. Afterwards, a man walked up to me. He said, my name is Hal, and I think you better stick with me. And inside, I felt better at that moment, I thought, finally. But of course, I had to let him know what a smooth and chic, debonair fellow he was hooked up with. But he was one of those hard old sponsors that had about that half a smile on his face every time I started to say something, and either finished it for me or let me know he didn't care to hear the rest. They got a thing out there for sponsors. It's called the Attila the Hun Academy. And they go there and learn how to be insensitive to suffering, sensitive alcoholics like me. That group was the first group that I ever said was a place that I belonged. You know, I didn't even belong to my own fraternity in college. People would ask me what fraternity I was in, I would just pass it off light, and they'd say, oh, are you a member of the house? And I'd say, well, yeah, I went active there, but I'm not active in it. You know, if you're never for something, you can never be measured. So I was always against everything. And that group was the first time I ever said, yeah, that's my group, right or wrong. Because that's the first place I ever made a commitment that they don't appreciate me and don't particularly like me. Now that's the guy who, if he ever asked a girl out for a date and she couldn't go, never asked her again. And that's the first time I ever had that sensation of that feeling. My sponsor was an out-of-work actor who had, coincidentally, all the time in the world for me. I had a lot of time on my hands at this point, too, because there had crept into my marriage a subversive factor. And we should warn you newcomers about it. I see they're coming out in the open tomorrow morning. Whatever you do, make sure you like what we have around here and don't let your spouse know about Al-Anon. I took years building up a technique to intimidate people so we didn't talk about me, and that organization shot it down overnight. When you are released with love, it's all gone. I owe my marriage and a good hunk of my sobriety to Al-Anon, and I know that. And I thank God for the fact that it is a family disease, because it took us as a family, in the case of my wife and I, working together finally to really start getting well. And I can tell you that now, that 10 years later, we are just now beginning to realize the depth and the breadth of that recovery as a family. We were talking to Wesley last night, and I was telling him about what I'm going through, and you know, and those old ones that always say, oh yeah, that's about where I was when I was there too, you know. Of course, I do it to the guys with 2 and 3 years. But you know, I think we're just now beginning to realize how sick we were corporately. Now, we're pretty aware of how sick we were individually. But I think now, after 10 years of on being on the program, we're beginning to become aware of how sick we were corporately. The interaction, the reaction-reaction syndromes. The, if you do this, I'll do that thing. The deep down feeling that if she didn't do this all these years, it would have been better. All those sick kind of things that we have interlocked our mutual illnesses, and it's hard disengaging them one at a time. I'd like to share something that we found that might be useful to you. It occurred to me one day that the 12 traditions of this program were designed to help we drunks get along with other people. I suppose keep them killing off some of us. It occurred to me that if those traditions were designed by the God of my understanding to help me get along with other people, they might work in getting along with my wife. We sat down the other day and started reading the traditions and trying to apply them to our marriage. And you know it works. It really works. They exactly fit. Isn't that funny? They've been telling me all this time that this is a complete and total program of living, and they weren't kidding. It really works. And I'd like to share that with you. And if you are having the kind of problems after you've been around the program a few years that we have, this may come as a shock to you, but we had a terrible fight a couple months ago. That fight's been one of the best things that's happened to us in a long time. Being honest. For the first times, I really told her what I was thinking. And for the first time, she really started to tell me what she thought about what I was thinking. And how relatively unimpressed she was. It's so nice to realize that we are a part of a spiritual program that is not for folks meditating in caves or abbots catching along in life. And it's a spiritual program that works exactly right for us. I don't know how it works in Atlanta, but it works fine in Parker. I'm sure it works here too. I had, after a year of not drinking and not doing anything else about it, attained, now I'm back to being special and unique again, but attained, I think, what was one of the better dry drunks that I have witnessed in a long time. A dry drunk is that period during which you are thinking and acting just as though you'd been drinking the whole time and don't have the benefit of alcohol. if you're not sure whether or not you're on a dry drunk, I'll give you my way for telling whether or not I'm on a dry drunk. That is, when everything is going to hell around you, and you're standing in the middle of it thinking, why is it I'm the only one who knows what's right? I seem to be the only one in the command of the situation. If they'd all just quiet down and listen, this thing's going to work out just fine. Well, I was in the middle of one of these things after a year of this. Trouble with dry drunks, too, is they sneak up on you. I had had a temper tantrum one day at work. Of course, I'd had it as any young corporate executive does. You know, I got mad at some salesman that worked for me and blew off at the secretary and all those things. But it is, in essence, a temper tantrum. Had I had a high chair, I would have been banging on the table. I dashed madly from the office. Wound up in a movie in South Pasadena, California, and began to sit down and watch this movie and maybe wonder there wasn't something to this God thing, because the message in this movie was absolutely beautifully crystal clear. This happens to be a movie called April Fools with Jack Lemmon, and in this, Jack is a darn fine guy, swell fellow, married to a miserable, misunderstanding woman, has a crummy job and a lousy boss, cursed with all kinds of people around him who are dragging him down, don't understand the reason he gets drunk from time to time, is that it's got to have some kind of relief. But he meets the woman who understands. The end of the movie is that he's racing down this long concourse in an airport, trying to make the plane she's on. I find myself standing in the theater and cheering for him. I decided that perhaps he is talking to me. Went home and announced that I was leaving home. This was a little out of sync with our conversations because just the night before we'd been talking about having some children. I certainly don't want to give you the impression that in my dry drunks I am given to sudden mood changes and irrational behavior. This was calm, well thought out, well meditated upon, and eminently logical. I would again quote Napoleon. Seemed like a good idea at the time. Subversives of Anonymous that she'd been attending came to the front after some agitated conversation, and my last words to me were, "Do you want the color television?" And I'm in a crummy apartment in West Los Angeles saying, what am I doing here? I thought I was in control of that situation. Little Dickie cried wolf once too often. Now he was playing with the big kids, and the big kids said, okay, if you're gonna play that way, then pay the piper. And now I'm alone, and I'm scared, and I began to search around for some way to feel better. And I began what I now look back upon as my saturation period. I was going to at least 2 AA meetings a day. It is during this period of time that I discovered a great truth for myself, that you do not work the program anonymous in a meeting. You may learn some of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in a meeting, but by going to lots of meetings will not give you or teach you the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a gentleman, Art, who's going to entertain us for the hearing, said tonight, it's an inside job. It cannot come from the outside. And the outside includes going to a lot of meetings, sitting there and thinking, all right, damn it, fix me. What that did was it got me to the state where I was walking out of meetings, as I've described before. That sponsor and I began spending every evening and all weekend long with one another. We would get in the car on Friday night and start driving around California, and it didn't matter where we went. We just drove and talked and stopped and ate and drove and talked and stopped and slept and got up the next morning and drove and talked. And we did that for 5 to 6 months, and that's what it took. It took that for me. It doesn't take that much for others, and it shouldn't have taken that much for me. But it took that long for him, in his patience and his love and his understanding, to erode away at that shell that I was living behind, about which I would make fun if it were someone else. I could see through other people's shells, and I was quick to point them out and quick to criticize them, but I couldn't see through my own. And it took that long and that much love and patience for him to work through that with me. I would like to share something about the continuation of that, because I believe it is part of the lesson that I've learned in AA. I, like many people, took my first sponsor and put him up on about as high a pedestal as you can put anybody. Because I was excited and I was alive and I was realizing that there was a God of my understanding who did love me, who had a place for me on this earth, that life was not something that just had to be killed. You just weren't here to kill time. And whoever killed time best won. And I put him up on a pedestal, and I overlooked the things that he was doing and saying which were inconsistent with the program. Now, he was the right man for me at the time, and I thank God for the love and the understanding that he gave me. But you know what began to happen after a while? He began to say, let's not go to that meeting because it's just a bunch of drunkalogs. Or let's not, you know, I don't want to go down there because so-and-so is trying to be president of AA, and I don't like that guy, and all those kinds of things. A particular kind of hell that he went through was that after I moved away soon after that from L.A. And I went back and I would see him every chance I got. And it happened the company I worked for, the office to which I reported, was in L.A., so I had a chance to get back often and see him. And we'd go out to dinner, we'd go to meetings together and everything else. And, you know, the whole time we were doing that, for 3 years, he was drinking. He finally, 5 years later, called me from an insane asylum in Southern California and asked for help from me. I don't bring that up for any reason other than the fact that this sign up here says we're all in this together. And we are all in this together, in my opinion, as sick people getting well. If you as a newcomer, like I did as a newcomer, have trouble with personalities, if you get people who preach at you or point their finger or do those other kinds of things, remember that those are sick people getting well also. Don't get hung up on the personalities. After the painful way of learning that, I finally looked around and realized they'd been saying it all along in the traditions. Concentrate on the principles, don't concentrate on the personalities. We are just sick people getting well. Now, there are some who have had experiences and who can express them, who can be a great help to us. And you're sure going to hear a couple of those gentlemen this weekend. You may wonder, as I did, why I'm on the program. Now, you'll get a chance to see the other two guys who are speaking this weekend. I want you to know, I am just here as the token young guy. For you newcomers, they want you to know that you can get sober and still have a chance for a love life before it's too late. Are they smiling? I could only do that to people I love. It's really a treat to be on the program with these two guys because they're some of the big hitters. The problem that I have had, one of the problems I've had in sobriety, has been that for a long time I suffered from what I refer to as the mentality of Band-Aid AA. Band-Aid AA says this. Yes, I had some problems with my drinking. Maybe I was cursed with a disease. But fundamentally and basically, I'm a pretty solid citizen and a pretty nifty package. I may have a couple of spots that need a little touching up. But if we just put some Band-Aids on a couple of those little sore points, we are going to again have that uniquely nifty little package that I was all the time before I stumbled across that bad rye whiskey. I have suffered deep and lingering problems because of that concept of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would like to instead offer for your consideration what I would call Metamorphosis AA. The concept of that is that alcoholism is a disease which permeates every physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual aspect of a human being. That whether or not we know it, we are sick. Whether or not we can measure it, we are ill, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, and physically. And that the only way that we can get true and real comfort, serenity, and peace of mind and self-respect back is to accept the theory that we need to be taken apart down to our smallest part. And for heaven's sakes, don't try to write the new diagram. And allow the pieces to be put back together in a way that's consistent with some program that has probably existed since time eternal. And process to take our individual parts and rearrange them, keep the ones that need keeping, and get rid of the ones that aren't useful any longer or are too sick or rusted to be useful. Realizing that the sum effect of that on down the line, and that reassembly process, in my opinion, will last the rest of my life. But the sum total of that process is probably going to be exactly what it was I was born into in the first place. And I'd like you to consider that as an alternative program to the one I tried to work for a long time. My first approach to the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous was, I read them on the wall and I thought, that's nice if all you have to do is agree with them. Now what? Sort of like a loyalty oath for the PTA. If you're willing to agree with them, then you belong here. Now what do you do? Well, I guess you go to meetings and you get busy and you do dumb things like empty coffee cups and stuff like that. And you try not to take that first drink and you try to impress everybody at home that you're a pretty nice guy now, despite the fact that you're continuing to behave pretty much like you behaved before you came into AA. For me to admit that I was powerless over alcohol, to admit that my life was still unmanageable after I had stopped drinking alcohol was very hard. Because again, I lapsed back into that concept that, well, God gave me a brain, right? How many times have you had a newcomer say, God gave me a brain, didn't he? Aren't I supposed to use it? I said, yeah, you are. But the problem was, I took that a step farther. I'm supposed to use it like I think I'm supposed to use it. There's a man up in Baltimore named Harold H. who's got a great thing. He says, you know, if you take an idiot box and you educate the devil out of that, you know what you got? An educated idiot box. That's all I had. Stupid actions are still stupid no matter how well you articulate them. My life today is more unmanageable than it was 10 years ago. I believe that very deeply. The reason is that I am 10 years closer. My friends in Denver have a nice way of saying it. Dick, remember, your best thinking got you to AA. Try not to think too much, Dick. Utilize, pray, and meditate. And come to the point where in the promises it says that we will begin to intuitively know that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And accept that as the amount of your manageability over yourself and your life. When I heard the word insanity in the second step, I thought, hot dog, there might be something to this. Because I knew I was not the same as other people mentally. Now, that was running down two tracks at the same time. I was not the same as everybody else mentally because I was, after all, the turning point in human intellectual development. But it also occurred to me that a lot of folks were driving down the freeways without thinking about driving into the abutments. I was living in Santa Barbara, and of course in my business, I used to have to drive by the Camarillo State Hospital, which is the Laughing Academy for Southern California. I had narrowed my options in life down to Camarillo or an honest suicide attempt. Now, I too have had suicide attempts, for those of you who have. It's almost par for the course before you get here. I suffered from the same problem that most of you probably did is, a big problem, of course, in suicide, is what to put in the note. I can distinctly remember, I can remember what time of day it was when I was sitting in my bedroom in a house we were renting in Coronado, California with a couple other guys I flew with. And I can remember the time of day, I can almost remember the temperature sitting there trying to compose the note. And I decided, and this made absolute sense to me at the time, that they didn't deserve a note. And then I went and I turned on all the gas jets. And I stuffed rags in all the windows, and I laid down, and I went to sleep. And I woke up 2 hours later with a splitting headache. and a profound sense of failure. The point of it stuck against my heart, and I laid there, and I with tears running down my face, wishing I had the guts to push it in. So I know what you felt like. We know. We really do know what you feel like. And that's insanity. And I found an answer for it here, and I hope that you do too. Because I know you can. Some of the greatest words in our big book is, it works. It really does. To make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the carrot's tough. I did that because all my prejudices. Now, I came in here blessed with as many spiritual and religious prejudices, I think, as anybody. But I had a moment of enlightened self-interest one night sitting in a meeting. That's called fear. When it occurred to me that the existence of God did not depend on whether or not I agreed with it. And I realized, hey, if they're right and I'm wrong, I'm in real trouble. Maybe with an open mind I should look into this phenomenon, the social aberration, which is probably really a form of mass hypnosis. In fact, it was at Beverly Hills Group, and I lived in Pasadena, and that's a long drive. And I had always had time to think over what I heard at the meeting that night. And you know, I remember driving down 3rd Avenue, heading down between Vermont and the freeway, and I recited the entire part of Chapter 5 to myself out loud that we read in the program, and I thought, I wonder where that came from. I could recite it verbatim. And I got home that night, and I went in, and I got down in a dark room, and I laid down on the floor in my face, and I started crying, and I said, God, I don't know who you are, but I am sick and tired of feeling like I feel inside. And a memory came to my mind that just before I stopped drinking one night, I was sitting, my wife was by this time going to sensitivity groups. I had her on tranquilizers at this point. That's the price you pay for getting qualified for Al-Anon. I used to make fun of her. Of course, I had taken those pills, but I didn't tell her that I used to have hangovers so bad that I'd steal her tranquilizers and put aspirin in their place. It occurred to me that one night, just before I stopped drinking, I was sitting in a house all by myself drinking port wine out of a silver cup. Right? You don't have a problem if you drink port wine out of a silver cup. Even if you drink the whole bottle that night there by yourself, it's all right if you got a silver cup. And I was sitting there, and I don't know what happened, but I suddenly, like I was pulled out of myself, and I could see myself sitting there doing that, and I started blubbering, and I said, oh God, I don't want to be like this. And that's the same thing I said the night that I got down. I laid down on the floor and started crying, and I said, God, I don't know who you are, but I need help, and I don't want to be like this anymore. I don't want to keep living like this. Because, you know, I'd been sober a couple years by this time. You know, I was all cleaned up nice on the outside. You know, people were saying, isn't it great he doesn't drink anymore? I was a bright, shiny new penny in AA. I was running around doing good works. Now I was doing 12-step work, and I was just terrific on the program. At L.A., though, you don't want to sober up in L.A., because they got some tough folks out there. During this period, I've got to show you this with you. I went tearing in the central office down on Harvard Street one day, and I got this book. I paid for this big book, and I told the gal, and she'd been there a long time, seen a lot of messiahs like me come and go. And I got a hot one, and I'm going to get out there and really lay it on him. And she waited until I was on my way out the door, and I had my back to her, and I'm on out the door, and she said, "It's a wonderful thing you're doing, Dick." Don't get sober in L.A. It's no fun. So there I was, cleaned up on the outside, bright, shiny, doing a great job, right? Doing wonderful at work. Somehow my behavior didn't seem to have changed much. It had only been modified slightly. And I realized that I was living as probably the biggest lie in my life. Here I was pretending to live a spiritual program, pretending to be involved in something meaningful that had to do with life and death, on which all these other people were depending very heavily. And I was putting on another facade. I had changed facades, and I felt just as dirty and just as sick inside. And I was more than willing to come to your meetings and speak for you. You know, in L.A. they have a lot of speaker meetings, and you kind of, once they hear you at one, they'll ask you that kind of thing. And you wind up doing a lot of that, and I realize I'm standing up there, and I'm just as hollow, and I'm just as dark, and I'm just as ugly inside as I was before. Because I had not had any kind of a cleansing experience. It was not an inside job with me at that point. I had not truly and completely given myself. Now, I had done my first 4-step and my first 5th step, and I did them as well and as honestly as I could. But the funniest thing happened was I stopped at 5. I remember reading in the 12x12, the opening of step 6, "This is the step that separates the men from the boys." And that made me uneasy. I tried, now that I had achieved this vast spiritual condition after having been sober for a couple of years, to change my character defects myself. And they got worse. They became heightened or accentuated. And I finally, through enlightened self-interest, came to realize that things were getting worse inside me and I had to do something about it. That not drinking alcohol was not what this program was all about. This program seemed to then come clearly to me as a program, it's a way of life, the involvement in which causes drinking or not drinking to no longer be an issue in my life. Drinking is no longer an issue in my life. I hope that I am 100% sincere and honest when I tell you that, and I say that with all the sincerity. That sounds very corny and very pat, and had I heard that in my early days in AA, I thought, oh yeah, I'm one of those. But I mean it. I mean it with every fiber of my being. Because it's by that simple thing, that simple not taking the first drink, which is predicated on the fact that I'm working this program through your love and concern and your patience and time and all the other kinds of things. I'm going on much too long. For me to make amends to other human beings was very difficult because it was truly the first time I walked outside in the world and said, I was wrong, I hurt you, I screwed up. I don't care what you tell me I have to do to make amends. You just tell me because I don't want to, because like I felt all my life. Jay and I have a very strong theory that making amends has nothing to do with saying you're sorry. I've been working on something recently I'd like to share with you, and the amends making thing has worked very well for me. I believe that there are times, obviously, and very clearly, that you have to go and you have to confront the person whom you have harmed and say, I am sorry for what I've done. I want you to know I'm sorry for what I've done. What can I do to make amends? And I think that's very right and very proper. I'm very much tuned into the traditions. Thank heavens, in Southern California, they were read at every meeting and they somehow got through my fog. When I put together steps 8 and 9 and the traditions that say, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our tradition. It occurred to me that maybe the best way to make real amends was in the spirit of anonymity. I had occasion recently to need to make amends to the firm for which I work because I had become I'm grateful for the fact that I was well employed, much better paid than I deserved. I was worried about what I wasn't getting instead of being grateful for what I was receiving. I was pretending, bitching and gossip and all became aware to me, and it became aware to me that I owe my firm amends, and I didn't know how to make them. So I did the things I'm taught to. I prayed, I met. He said, here are the principles involved, but I can't tell you. He said, you're the one, you and the God of your understanding, and see, this is the right kind of sponsor. He doesn't try to run my life. He tries to share his life with me, sharing his advanced years and experience and insights. And so I did. I prayed and meditated about it. And I figured out that I needed two kinds of amends. Number one, I needed to make amends to the man for whom I directly worked, because I had not kept him abreast of a potential problem out of pride. The problem didn't come to fruition, but that didn't matter. I owed him that. So I went to him and I said, I have done you wrong, and here's how I have done you wrong. And I explained it and laid it all out. And like in almost all amends cases, you know, you're expecting this big, heavy thing to come out of it. He smiled and he just said, well, that's great, Dick. I appreciate it very much. Went on talking about business. You know, that's usually what happens. You go in there expecting a Betty Davis movie, you know, and you get Looney Tunes, you know. I walked out of his office. I guess I'll show you what I'm fooling around with here in this higher power. I walked out of his office, walked down the hall, turned the corner to go to the elevator, and there was another fellow from the firm there, and he said, by the way, he said, oh, great, I'm glad I ran into you. You and I need to talk to so-and-so down on the next floor about something in business. I walked down, talked to so-and-so on the next floor. The first guy leaves. The second guy and I are standing there talking about the fact that we would like to start a Bible study in our office. And we talk about how we're going to do it, and we're going to da-da-da-da, and I start to walk out the door, and it dawned on me. That's how I make amends to my firm, is by participating in something spiritual and positive and being behind it and taking some effort. I don't believe amends count unless it hurts a little bit. It takes a little effort. And I turned around and walked back in his office. Fortunately, he and I share a certain religious thing together so that we can talk this way. And I said, you're not going to understand this, but God bless you, and I appreciate the fact that you and I just worked out under the direction of the God that we understand on how I needed to make amends to this firm. And that's how it works for me. That's how it works. He's right there, a breath away, all the time. Step 10 is the process which I try to adhere to every day. It is the one which I tend to slide over in the evening particularly. But over and over again, because my home group happens to be a big book study group, and they keep going over that thing about we look for where we were selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, or afraid. And if I can just do that at the end of the day, then I'm okay. Step 11 to me is the eternal journey. That is the doorway into the infinite experience that I am able to have here in the program of AA. I told you I came here with all the spiritual and religious prejudices that anybody could have. I then began to find out that the big book said a lot of things I missed the first time through. Be sure to see where religious people are right. And all those kinds of things. So I began to set out and to find out for myself and answer questions for myself about things that I had never understood but made fun of all my life. And so I read and I studied and I went and I looked and I did all those kinds of things. And I found out that what we have been given here, in my opinion, are the same spiritual principles that have always existed. But for some reason in 1935, the God of my understanding saw fit to combine them together and put them in the specific application for a specific disease. But those principles are the same that have always been. And that is my opinion. But I have found that to be true by reading and studying every kind of ismanology that I could lay my hands on. Step 12 is the thing which I tried to put too much emphasis on, part of. And that was carrying the message the alcoholic who still suffers. And so darned little emphasis on the last part, which is to practice these principles in all my affairs. The hardest thing I'm going to do for the rest of my life is to be a spiritual man where it reflects in the relationship with my wife and my children, the people with whom I work, and my fellows in the program of AA. That's the hardest thing I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And the reason it's the hardest thing is that I am totally unequipped of myself for doing that. I possess nothing of myself, in my opinion, which would allow me to accomplish that role and mission in life. I don't know why God didn't let me die the times I drove drunk off mountain passes in Colorado and all the other things that I had, except maybe that He had some reason, some use for this particular life. I don't know what that is for tomorrow or at 5 minutes from now. But I can look back over the last 10 years and tell you what it was for. I know why He's kept me alive and why He's kept me going. It's so that I could participate in this program and be of some use in some way for Him sometime down the line. Almost always in occasions when I least suspect it and I'm ready for it. That's why I have to rely on the steps to prepare me for that on a daily basis. I pray to the God of my understanding that You will find here what You're looking for. And I also pray to the God of my understanding that You will really come to know what it is You're looking for. Because I don't think we know that when we come here. We think we come here, I believe, to get the monkey off our back, to get the boss off our back, to get the pressure and all the hassles that go with alcoholic drinking. That's what I thought I came here for, and it isn't. What I came here for is the stillness and the quietness that I find in those rare moments when I am truly catapulted into that third dimension, that fourth dimension of spiritual living. I am in the world of the Spirit as often as I want to be. And for those of you who are new, after all the words are said, after all that I have said tonight and tried to share with you the program of AA and what it's meant to me, please remember that what counts is that you are sitting in a room of people who have come through a total amount of darkness and sickness and ugliness far beyond your comprehension. To add up the ugliness and the sickness that we all have corporately experienced would really be beyond description. But you ought to see you. You are beautiful. You dress up and clean up lovely. And out there, I've been looking for all my life. And that's why it is truly, truly a blessing to have been asked to come here and to share my little corner of the program with you, to tell you that God is alive and well in Parker as He is in Atlanta. And we thank You very much, and I love You very much. Thank you.